Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. We've been talking a lot in recent days about policing and crime and the system that tries to keep citizens safe. Today, we're talking about another angle on that, mass incarceration and a push on the political right to end it. More than a dozen states have launched serious criminal justice reform efforts in recent years, with conservatives often leading the charge. In Maryland this year, Republican Governor Larry Hogan led the effort passed by the majority Democrat legislature called Justice Reinvestment. It aims to steer drug offenders toward treatment instead of prison and eliminate mandatory minimum sentences for some drug crimes, as well as many other aspects. Governor Hogan is considered more moderate than many high-profile conservatives in the national debate calling for changes to the penal system, from Georgia's Newt Gingrich to Arkansas's Asa Hutchinson. How did tough-on-crime conservatives come to fight for the end of mass incarceration? Locking lots of people up is expensive, and fiscal conservatism is, of course, a hallmark of the right. But authors of a new book argue that the conservative conversion on incarceration goes deeper than the dollar. In Prison Break, Why Conservatives Turned Against Mass Incarceration, Steve Tellis and David Dagan argue that a drop in crime and a growing hostility to big government were among the factors that led conservative leaders to fight for criminal justice reform. How did it happen? What does the bipartisan embrace of criminal justice reform portend for the future of incarceration in this country? And does the singular point of agreement between liberals and conservatives have anything to teach us about bipartisanship in general? The authors are here with me in the studio. Steve Tellis is Associate Professor of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University and a fellow at the New America Foundation. Welcome to Midday.
Thanks for inviting me.
I'm glad you're here. And David Dagan is a doctoral student in political science at the Johns Hopkins University. Welcome.
Hi.
Am I pronouncing your name right?
Dagan. But Dagan is a very common pronunciation. So.
That's how I pronounce it.
That's right.
Dagan is French?
Israeli, of all things.
Oh, okay. Well, welcome.
Yes.
And let me ask either one of you before we go into the question that you pose on the cover of your book about why conservatives turned against mass incarceration. What is the proof that conservatives have turned against mass incarceration?
So there's a couple different dimensions. One, you might think it was organizational, and the other is legislative. So organizationally, a number of major conservative organizations now are clearly on the side of pushing for reductions in incarceration. Some of your listeners probably heard of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is the organization of conservative state legislators. They're famous for having pushed for stand your ground laws, lots of other notorious conservative changes. They're also now on the side and have been for a number of years now on the side of reducing incarceration. They're pushing model legislation to states to do changes like that. And there's a number of other conservative organizations. But more importantly, lots of conservative bright red states have done major reforms that have reduced the growth in incarceration, and in many cases just absolutely reduced the amount of incarceration. Texas famously in 2007, which was really seen as the beginning of this this trend. Georgia has now gone through multiple different waves of reform under a exclusively Republican-controlled government. Mississippi, which is, you know, which we always expect to do things last or to do it kicking and screaming, has gone through a couple of different waves of reform. And it's those different Republican states who are doing it for their own reasons. And again, importantly, are coming back to the well. They're not just doing it as a one-off. It's now something that's been sort of institutionalized. And every year or every couple of years, they're coming back and following up. And so that's really, I think, the evidence that something's changed. Less on the federal level for reasons we can talk about.
Yeah, it's stalled in Congress, right?
It's been stalled in Congress. The important thing, again, for your listeners to remember, though, is a very small percentage of all the people who are locked up in this country are locked up in federal prisons, just over a little over 10%. So that means that the federal government could do nothing in this. You know, so long as the states were still acting, a lot could get done. So and this is one of those few areas where the federal government is really much, much less important than what state governments do.
David Dagan, how does Maryland fit into this picture? I mean, Steve Tellis just talked us through some really red states. And obviously Maryland is a blue state with a Republican governor.
Yeah. So as you noted in the introduction, Maryland just this year passed a very ambitious package aimed at reducing incarceration in our prisons. And in fact, the prediction is that over 10 years, it'll reduce the number of prisoners in this state by about 5%, 1,200 people. So that's not an enormous number, but it's certainly better than what the projection was, which was for the prison population to be growing in this state by 6%.
And that's a projection of a reduction over how many years?
10 years.
10 years.
Maryland is a blue state, but we have a Republican governor. As you note, he's more of a moderate than folks than the governors of a state like Texas or Georgia might be. But nonetheless, he was very much on board with this, and in fact, in sort of a cheerleading role from the very start. And there were some Republican legislators, conservative legislators, who played key roles in getting this thing moved through. Were there to do the negotiating when necessary, and to cajole some of their more conservative colleagues. Probably the most important was a guy named Michael Huff, a state senator, who has long been a champion of these kinds of reforms, did some work on mandatory minimum reform even before this year here in Maryland, and is a card-carrying member of ALEC, in fact used to work for the American Legislative Exchange Council, which I think has informed a lot of his thinking on this.
So the question that you pose in your title, why have conservatives turned against mass incarceration?
So the in a way, what we need to do is start at the question of why does anybody in a highly polarized environment change their mind?
Okay, let's start there.
And one of our arguments is that there's a lot of people who think that people change their mind because of evidence, right? So people are rationally processing information. They get new data and they update. And, you know, everybody, when they look in the mirror, thinks that they changed their mind for that reason, right? We all think of ourselves as rational that way. But our argument is that most people, especially in highly polarized environments, process information not by asking, is this true or are false? Is it empirically correct? But they ask themselves, is this the kind of thing that a person like me believes, right? Now, they may not believe that when they look in the mirror, but that's how they really process information. There's tons of evidence for that. So the reason—
And I think, gratuitously, okay. I'll make the point. It seems to me we're seeing a lot of that in the past week with the people who feel they have to line up supporting the officers who were shot in Dallas, and the people who feel they have to line up supporting the Black Lives Matter, and that you can't support both.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think a lot of people believe what it's convenient for them to believe, and they believe what's consistent with all the other beliefs that they have, right? Because changing your mind, for the most part, is painful, right? Taking in information that's inconsistent with the way you view the world is very difficult, and people go out of their way to avoid doing it. All of us do, right? All of us, in a way, have that kind of selective perception where we look even subliminally for information that reinforces what we already believe, and we avoid looking for information that doesn't, right? So the question is, once conservatives had developed this position of being tough on crime, they processed information in a way that reinforced that, right? So they ignored evidence that that there was really high rates of recidivism as a result of incarceration. They ignored evidence on family, impacts on family, all these other things. For a long time, conservatives ignored until suddenly they didn't. And our point in the book is that really starts happening in the mid to late 2000s, when suddenly lots of the things that were reinforcing conservatives and keeping their previous position stopped applying.
Lots of things.
Like, first of all, the enormous drop in crime. And that plays a role in our story because with the enormous drop in crime, the consequence of that is the public simply stops fearing as much. If you look at the polls that say, what's the three most important issues to you? When I was a kid in college in D.C., 86 to 89, this would have been one of the top three issues for an enormous part of the population, and politicians paid attention to that. Politicians care about salience, how important something is to people, right? By the end of the 2000s, that had dropped precipitously to where it was, in some polls, hardly able to be measured, right? And what that meant is ordinary working politicians were no longer having to give up something that was putting food on their table, right? That was getting them elected. And therefore, that made them more open to hearing about why their previous position of being tough on crime was problematic. At the same time, in our story, a cadre of conservative reformers who really start with people like Chuck Colson, who was a famous Watergate conspirator who went to jail, who then becomes a evangelical kind of superstar. One thing he does is he puts the idea that conservatives shouldn't be reflectively in favor of long sentences, puts that really on the agenda of conservatives. And along with Pat Nolan, who worked with him as a kind of his sort of political sidekick, they create this cadre, very small, often pretty off the radar screen for a long time. But they start this very slow work of persuading conservatives so that when Texas makes its big reform in 2007, that gets followed up with the creation of this organization called Right on Crime that brings together these reformers who had done work in Texas with this national cadre that Colson and Nolan had put together. And that's why suddenly you start seeing all of this reform and all these people, conservatives, starting to sing a different tune.
You're moving us really quickly through a whole lot of stuff. Let me just remind listeners, that's Steve Tellis, Associate Professor of Political Science at Johns Hopkins University, here on Midday on WIPR. We're talking about a book that he has written with David Dagon called Prison Break, Why Conservatives Turned Against Mass Incarceration. And you can be part of this conversation. Do you consider yourself a conservative? What are your thoughts about how the criminal justice system works and prison in particular? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I don't want to lose the thread of what you're talking about, but it's too tempting not to ask you, one of you, to take a minute to tell us more about these players. Chuck Colson, from Watergate fame, I think many of our listeners will know that his consciousness was raised from the time he spent in prison, and he became quite an advocate for prison reform and for prison ministry. But most of us haven't heard of Pat Nolan.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about him.
Let me start on Colson, and then David can talk about Nolan. The important thing to remember about Colson is that it's not just that he comes out of prison and he's in favor of prison reform, right? What's really important is he comes out of prison as a born-again Christian, right? And one of the most important born-again Christians in the United States, right? This is not, you know, evangelical Christianity is not like the Catholic Church, which has a hierarchy and everybody knows who's in charge and the archbishop is whoever speaks, right? Evangelicals become powerful in that community by the regard they have from others, right? The crowd they can get. And Colson really was considered to be, purely as a religious figure, one of the most important figures among evangelicals and among conservatives. And that's important for our story because the kind of people who can persuade ideological actors, right, are not people in the middle, are not people in the center. And that's why we're suspicious of the term bipartisanship, which gives you a kind of image of centrist, moderate actors, right? The people who can do this work are people who have unquestioned identity in their community, in this case, the conservative community, right? Because they're the ones who can say, look, I'm as conservative as you are. I'm really one of the people who is the arbiters of what's conservative and liberal. And I'm telling you that the position we had before was not the conservative position. I'm not asking you to moderate. I'm asking you to rethink what it means to be conservative. And Colson, because of his position in that community and the fact that nobody could say, oh, you're really a Quisling. You're really somebody who's a liberal and
you're a rhino.
Clothing.
You're a Republican in name only.
Right.
No one can say that.
Right. Nobody could say that about Colson. And that's why he had such an enormous power to be able to do this work in a way that some moderate wouldn't.
David Dagon, before I let you tell us about Pat Nolan from California, we have to take a quick break. So we'll talk about that when we come back with David Dagon and Steve Tellis, a political scientist from Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about their book, Prison Break, Why Conservatives Turned Against Mass Incarceration. And you can be part of this conversation. I'm curious as to what you think about the movement that we're describing, this justice reinvestment movement, this movement against mass incarceration. Does it please you, or do you think that the pendulum is swinging too far too fast? Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about mass incarceration and conservative efforts to end it. My guests are political scientists Steve Tellis and David DeGan. They both from Johns Hopkins. They are the authors of Prison Break: Why Conservatives Turned Against Mass Incarceration. David DeGan, you were going to tell us about this interesting character who is really sort of the beginning of the book, Pat Nolan, a kid who grew up in Los Angeles.
That's right. Pat Nolan is, for my money, the most important player after Chuck Colson in the conservative rethinking of criminal justice and in persuading conservatives that it's time to make a break with the last 40 years of policy. And just like we said, Chuck Colson had unquestioned conservative bona fides and therefore could tell people on the right things they didn't want to hear. Pat Nolan was also uniquely placed to do that. And working as a deputy to Colson, I would say he's the guy who actually leveraged the reputation of his boss, this evangelical star, to really get people to start changing their minds. So Nolan was born in Los Angeles, grew up as an early fan of Barry Goldwater's, actually volunteered for the insurgent campaign of that Republican back in 1964, and later went on to become an acolyte of Ronald Reagan's, volunteering for him and ending up in the California legislature, where he was perceived as a real rising star. And while there, he voted for more money for prisons. He helped open the Supermax at Pelican Bay. He helped pass a Victims' Bill of Rights, and he considered himself a guy who was very much on the side of law and order and law enforcement. He was very popular with police and prosecutors. But Nolan, like Colson, ended up in prison. Nolan got busted by the FBI in a rather bizarre sting operation that involved federal agents posing as lobbyists for a shrimp processing company. And that kind of crazy prosecution landed Nolan in a federal prison for a couple of years. And that is a place where he really reexamined his beliefs, and he says, realized that what we do in prisons is not what he thought we did in prisons, and that people don't get better when they got locked up, and that people often go behind the walls for the wrong reasons. And that began really his mission of trying to persuade other conservatives to rethink what they had been doing.
So you said a few minutes ago, Steve Tellis, that to be someone who can change the opinion of your group, to be someone who can influence, I think the word you political scientists use in the book is identity vouchers.
Yes.
To be an identity voucher, you need to have unquestioned credentials for the group. But is it also the case, from the two stories you've told us, the two characters you've described to us, that you need to have experienced personally some kind of epiphany, some kind of you need to have a personal story to persuade others?
Well, I mean, it is the case that in those two cases, and I think that explains their motivation, right? Explains why they cared so much about it. I don't think that explains why they're persuasive to others, right? I don't think the fact they've been in the prison gave them more credibility. It was the fact they were conservative that gave them credibility, right? Now, the fact they've been in the prison gave them knowledge. It got them up in the morning, right? Which is the most important thing in politics, right? Is that you need at least a few people who care about this so deeply that they're willing to make it their life's work, right? And I think there's a number of other figures that we've seen in the conservative movement who've also been touched. Either their kids have gone to the prison, the head of Families Against Mandatory Minimums, the brother went to prison for a very shaky, but for a very long time. And so I do think one consequence of the fact that we've built this system of mass incarceration is it's not a surprise that eventually it's sort of grown to start touching even people at the very top of society. And again, most of the people who are involved in this don't have any of that direct connection, but a small number, but also a very important number of them have, and that's given them a kind of fire in the belly. And the other thing I would just say, just to go back to a point you were making earlier, we had talked about in the introduction, you said this isn't just about money. That's one of the parts of our argument. And it's important to note that for both Colson and Nolan, right, come out of this really as much out of religious faith as they do out of any kind of fiscal conservative, fiscal conservatism. And so it's interesting that those social conservatives really were the people who arguably were doing the most on this issue when the times were darkest, right? When before any of the window of opportunity had opened up that reducing prison numbers had created. And so they're a really important part of the coalition. It's important to keep that in mind.
And if I could just jump in on this question of true believers, I mean, the other group of people who have joined this conservative prison reform movement is the libertarians and those who are very sort of hostile to government and generally suspicious of government. So one of the earliest allies that Pat Nolan found when he started working in Washington was Grover Norquist, the leader of Americans for Tax Reform, which is the group that famously wants to shrink government to the size where it could be drowned in the bathtub.
Right.
And so the point is that conservatives who are deeply skeptical of government being able to efficiently or effectively perform virtually any task used to sort of exempt prisons from that critique. They used to think that government can't do a good job of educating children and doesn't do a good job of providing welfare and can't manage the economy well. And now they've realized that prisons also don't work as they should. Prisons are also bureaucracies.
For a long time, they did not level that critique at prisons.
That's right. They provided an exemption for the arms of law and order. As Norquist himself says, he thinks that the generals were in charge and that that one function of government that everybody agrees is essential, providing public safety, was being handled properly. Taking a closer look, conservatives have now concluded that there is a lot of bureaucratic pathology in the criminal justice system, and that sort of libertarian spirit has, I think, put a lot of energy into this movement.
Right. And it's not an accident that a lot of this happens at the same time as the Tea Party energy starts coming, which we understand in a way is kind of radicalizing conservatism, right? Taking that anti-government spirit that was always there and extending it even, making it so radical that it starts extending even to the military, surveillance, and as we talk about in the book, public safety.
That is Steve Tellis of Johns Hopkins, a political scientist, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here with me is David DeGon. Together they are authors of Prison Break, Why Conservatives Turned Against Mass Incarceration. I'm interested in what you're thinking about this, listeners. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. Does it surprise you that many red state conservatives are leading a charge to curb prison growth? Give us a call or send us an email. We had a caller who I guess could not stay with us who wanted to say that Germany has a better approach than the United States, that Germany actually rehabilitates people in prison. Are any of you familiar with approaches elsewhere in the world?
I'm actually from Germany originally.
Oh, well, tell us then, David DeGon.
So, and the caller is right. European prisons in general tend to be different than American prisons, less austere, more focused on providing programming and educational opportunities for inmates. And I do think that we have a lot to learn from that. In fact, a delegation from the United States last summer toured Germany and visited a bunch of their prisons to see what they could learn. I know the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections secretary was along on that trip and, based on his testimony, was rather impressed. I think for our purposes, maybe the point here is that for the first time in a long time, people are willing to think about those lessons and learn those lessons. People are willing to believe that there is something we can learn from the European approach to crime control, which 20 years ago would have just sounded ludicrous because it's coddling criminals. It's being soft, right? Prisons, there was an era in which we thought prisons ought to be there to punish, not to rehabilitate. And part of the achievement, I think, of the evangelicals is that they've managed to sort of humanize prisoners and make help conservatives to think of them as wayward souls or fallen people who need to be redeemed. And so the whole the way we view the people who are incarcerated is changing on the right in a really important way that I think opens the door to changing the way prisons are run down the road.
Yeah, my friend Mark Kleiman, who teaches at NYU, says at least up until recently, conservatives thought of punishment as a benefit rather than the cost. That is, the punishment itself, the imposition of punishment, was itself, right, you know, kind of cathartic, right? And part of our argument is that conservatives are increasingly...
I'm sorry, I'm still hung up on that. Okay. The conservatives thought of the punishment as a feature, not a flaw. I'm not quite
As a benefit, in the sense that they liked the idea that people who did bad things were being punished, and the fact that if prisons were bad places where people were being abused or people were being raped, well, all the better, right? And that's part of what you mean about not really having a sense of solidarity with those, even people who've done bad things. And that's one thing that social conservatives have brought to this, is to say that even people who are fallen, even people who've committed terrible crimes, are still human beings. They're still citizens. They're still creatures of God, and they can be redeemed. Now, again, that's a different way of thinking about it than liberals have, right? Liberals often tend to think about, well, criminals, right, can be redeemed, but they really are victims, right? Conservatives generally don't think of criminals as victims. So they've got a very different frame, and that's part of what we mean by this politics being transpartisan. It's not that people are converging on the reasons why they want to do things, right? They've got very different worldviews and very different reasons about why they want to change, right? But they can come together often on what exactly it is they want to do.
So I want to double down on that word, because I wasn't familiar with it until your book. You talk about transpartisanship, not bipartisanship. And is that the nugget, the core difference, that people come together in the same room for different reasons? That's transpartisanship. People find they share the same reasons. That's bipartisanship.
Yeah, let's go in the Wayback Machine to like 1970s, right? And there were lots of really big bipartisan changes that happened in the 1970s. But that was a period in which you had, for example, in Congress, you had a lot of Democrats who were to the right of lots of Republicans, and you had lots of Republicans who were to the left of lots of Democrats, right? We no longer have that. There's no center in Congress. There's no center in most state legislatures anymore, right? Most of them are made up by conservative Republicans and liberal Democrats, right? And what that means is when there's no center, there's no opportunity for a kind of center-out coalition. From now on, transpartisan coalitions are coalitions that are made up usually of the most ideologically coherent, the most right or the most left people who come at it for their own reasons, not because they're being brought together by the center, not because they're being brought together by establishment institutions in the way that was more characteristic of how we used to do bipartisan change 30 or 40 years ago.
But I still don't understand in the story that you tell, and part of it is, I think, because I first learned about justice reinvestment efforts here in Maryland. And I was very much aware that the Pew Foundation, I forget which of the many manifestations of the Pew brand it was, but Pew did the staffing, basically. They came up with the data on which Maryland drafted its legislation. So I'm very much aware that, at least in the unfolding of it that I saw in this state, the liberals and the conservatives worked together on it. I don't understand, in the way you tell this political story, how the conservatives, especially in states where they were driving it, as you describe, that how they could work with liberals without losing that conservative identity, which you've said was so important to actually getting to where they got in changing the conservative position on mass incarceration. Why was it not seen as a form of weakness to be consorting with the liberals on how to structure prisons?
So I think it's worth sort of separating the political work from the policymaking work. And foundations like Pew have been very important in helping with the policymaking, providing the sort of nuts and bolts tools and numbers and recommendations for what ought to be done once we've agreed that there's a problem and we want to reduce the number of people in prison. But in general, the alliance of conservatives with liberals has been rather arm's length on this. It's been sort of mediated by those foundations, and the sort of political rhetoric that you hear from each side is rather different. So I think, you know, politically, conservatives have sort of developed their own reasons for doing this thing, but they still have to work with Democrats. Republicans still have to work with Democrats, even in states where they're in the majority. They've worked with Democrats on these projects. I think the point is that they've been able to avoid the charge of consorting with the enemy because they're able to frame the project in such deeply ideological conservative terms.
Right. And that's something, just to say, that Pew, which is a very centrist foundation, was very smart in knowing that even though their politics were centrist, that to make this work, they needed to get ideological, as we talked about, identity vouching on the far right and the far left.
Deborah has called us from Baltimore. Deborah, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I'm wondering how prison reform is and will affect the disproportionate number of African Americans. I don't hear that discussed in what you're saying about social conservative commitment to prison reform, since invariably race is not their priority.
Interesting question. I'm glad you brought us there. I was planning to get there. Let me, Deborah, before I ask our guest to answer what you're talking about looking ahead, let me ask you, one of you to tell us how race played into where conservatives were on mass incarceration, and is it playing into the reforms?
Yeah, so we, I think, have a slightly more subtle, of course, everyone thinks their argument is subtle, our argument on this, that we do think that race played an important part in the development of Republicans' position starting in the 1960s and 1970s, but that it was mixed in with a whole lot of other things. You go back to the 1960s and 1970s, remember that there's a general sense that social order is coming unwound in all kinds of ways, right? Protests on college campuses, which are mainly white kids, crime, of course, drugs, family, all these things were all wrapped up in ways that make it really hard to disentangle what role race specifically played. So I think that it plays a role with Republicans on that side. It's part of that general sense of disorder that Republicans realized they could take advantage of and run against Democrats on. And I think race plays an even more important role, though, in the degree to which people thought, once we saw some of the consequences of the growth of mass incarceration, the degree to which people thought, well, this is a really big problem, we have to do something about it. I think there's a good argument that if we had been incarcerating anywhere near the number of white people that we incarcerate, that the cost of that incarceration on families, on neighborhoods, on everything else would have been processed by the political system and would have been processed by conservatives differently than the fact that it was being that these costs were being imposed on African Americans.
David?
Yeah, and to bring it to the present, Deborah makes a very astute observation. Race is fairly absent from the conservative discourse about the problems of mass incarceration. There are some prominent people on the right who have talked in very vocal terms about race. Rand Paul comes to mind as somebody who's decried the drug war and even invoked the phrase of the new Jim Crow. But that's pretty rare. Most conservatives have shied away from the racial dimensions of this. I think that is probably a limitation of the movement so far. But I think there's some reason for optimism as well as pessimism. On the plus side, I think that savvy Republicans have realized that doing prison reform and advocating for reining in the excesses of mass incarceration gives them a way to speak to the black community in an era where they have very little to offer African Americans and minorities in general. So in Georgia, for example, the Republican governor, Nathan Deal, reached out in his reelection campaign to the black community, sent flyers, recruited clergy to speak on his behalf, and really played up the notion that he had done something that would benefit the African American community by reducing incarceration in Georgia. I think at the national level, Paul Ryan sees some possibilities there as well. On the pessimistic side, I think it's also true that the more liberals pound on the race issue, for reasons that I sympathize with, the more liberals pound on that issue, and especially the more it becomes wrapped up and combined with the questions over police brutality that have so gripped us in the last few weeks, the more likely conservatives are to revert back to their old instincts of a sort of defensive law and order crouch. And I think that's a risk that liberals need to think about when they're trying to address the racial issue in incarceration. It's going to be a tough balancing act.
I'd be interested in hearing from some of our listeners about what they think of it. We're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll continue this discussion about mass incarceration, the reform movement, what's behind it from the conservative side. You can join this conversation by sending an email to midday@wypr.org or phoning us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm talking today with Johns Hopkins political scientist Steve Tallis and David DeGaan, authors of Prison Break, Why Conservatives Turned Against Mass Incarceration. We're taking your calls and questions at 410-662-8780 or emails at midday@wypr.org. We got a midday from Dave in Baltimore, who actually wrote this before you made your last point, David DeGaan, but seems to have known what you were going to say. Part of what Dave wrote was, why not be an advocate for the incarcerated? He said, how about this explanation? Why not be an advocate for the incarcerated with the hope that they'll be advocates for the Republican Party in the inner city? Some returned citizens can be great advocates, and if they can advocate for voters, it may just win elections from the local to the national level. Are there any statistics to indicate this? Do you have any sense that Republicans see a play for African American votes?
So I've actually done some research on sort of past efforts by Republicans to reach out to African Americans, and a couple of things are worth saying. One is Republicans get almost no votes from African Americans. I mean, almost remarkably low. I don't think most Republicans think that doing something on this is really going to get them a sizable percentage of the black vote, although in some states they might be able to do that. More important probably is the influence it's going to have on white voters, right? White voters who are open to voting for conservatives but don't like to think of themselves as racist, don't like to think of themselves as intolerant. So in some sense, part of this as a political matter is kind of a bank shot, right? It's not so much they're going directly at black voters as it is that you're trying to go at white voters by being less mean and less punitive to African Americans. That said, Republicans don't need to increase their vote too much in the black community, at least in some pivotal states like Florida, Ohio, states like that, where races are often decided by 1%, 2% to really make a difference. And I think Republicans know that just giving all of the black vote over the Democrats before they even start playing the game really does put them behind the eight ball.
Mike is calling us from Annapolis. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hear me okay?
We hear you not okay. I mean, we're hearing a lot of wind noise or traffic noise or something. But
I'm in the car, so that should be better.
That's better. Okay.
So I wanted to address a comment made earlier about European prisons versus American prisons and how they focus on rehabilitation. And that's something I definitely believe in. I believe rehabilitation is something we should be focusing on. However, I also feel that we should be making a distinction based on the sentence and the punishment for the crime committed. So somebody who has life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, I feel should be treated differently behind bars, meaning that they should, really, what's the point of rehabilitating them? They're never getting out. They did something so horrible that they've got life in prison. So they should probably be punished, not rehabilitated, whereas somebody for a drug charge or, I don't know, theft or something like that, we should definitely focus on rehabilitation. What's your thoughts?
My own thought is, I think without knowing in detail how one runs a prison, is that if you're going to make it a place of rehabilitation, it would be hard to limit that. But I could be wrong about that. What do either of you think about it?
I mean, just two points, if I could. One is that Europe essentially doesn't have lifers. So that's one thing that makes the United States distinct. There is no life without parole for the most part in Europe. And in fact, that incredibly harsh punishment is quite distinctive here in the United States. But I think the broader issue that the caller raises is that there are classes of criminals that we can sort of distinguish between and treat differently. And in particular, in American politics, we like to draw a distinction between violent and nonviolent criminals. And in Maryland, this was done. In this most recent reform, it's been actually a staple of the conservative reform movement as well, to say we're going to focus on our efforts on nonviolent criminals and getting them better, and then we're going to lock up and put away the violent criminals. For reasons we can get into if there's time, I think that's actually a pretty flawed framework for thinking about this issue and rather a limitation on the reform project.
Can you give me the short version of the flaw?
The short version is that it's not easy to decide who's violent and nonviolent. The distinctions aren't as clean as we might think. And people who are violent in their 20s are not necessarily going to be violent in their 40s. In fact, it's quite unlikely that they will be.
Right. And one thing I think that we – right. So one thing we know, right, is that people graduate out of criminal behavior. The other thing to remember, though, is if you really want to reduce prison numbers significantly, you can't do it with nonviolent criminals, right? If you look at the reasons why we had the huge spike in incarceration that starts really in the 1980s, it's not just because we started throwing lots of people in jail for dealing pot behind a school, right? It's because we increased the sentences for things that everybody thinks that people should be punished for somewhat, right? We increased the sentences for murder, for rape, for armed robbery, for all those crimes, right?
And
violent crimes. And if we're really going to push incarceration down, we've got to figure out a way to reduce incarceration for things that everyone thinks should be a crime. The other part I would say here is that if we're really going to do that, we actually have to be able to have something other than prison to give people that's actually a punitive form of response, right? And right now, we'd talked before we were on air about parole and probation. Right now, in most states, parole and probation are just a status, right? They don't make people do anything. They're not really supervising them. They're not surveilling them. And if we're really going to push prison numbers down, we need to be thinking about how do we actually make parole and probation something that can really control people as well as rehabilitate people. And I have to say, you know, maybe compared to David, I'm slightly more skeptical of how much we actually know how to do about rehabilitation. But we do know that prison has at least some degree of criminogenic effect, right? That prison itself
means it causes crime.
Yeah,
it generates crime.
Right. It hardens people. It creates criminal networks. Right, crime is a business, and you're putting people in contact with lots of people who they can do business with in the future. And for all those reasons, we should try and avoid using it as much as possible. But we don't, in large part, because we lack other kind of punitive responses like really significant parole and probation.
We don't have a lot of minutes left, and I do want to cover some current topics. Like, you write when you're describing where law and order policies and ideology came from, you write about the rhetoric of disorder from conservative politicians in the middle decades of the 20th century, like Ronald Reagan. How does the Trump campaign play into this? He has billed himself as a law and order candidate. How does he fit into this conservative attempt to dismantle mass incarceration? Do you expect it?
Yeah, I mean, we think about, so I was, there's a great article by Rick Perlstein, who some of your listeners may have heard of, who wrote an article about Donald Trump as a sort of 1980s New York conservative. And when you think about that, some people might remember people like Morton Downey Jr., who was a sort of angry New York conservative, right? Trump really is a kind of throwback to an older form of conservatism, the kind of conservatism that Rudy Giuliani had. Or if you think about all the things that are part of the conservative anti-mass incarceration coalition, an emphasis on compassion, on forgiveness, and on skepticism of government, right? None of those things are really present in Trump. Trump is really, in a way, a revolt against both of those elements of both social conservatism and anti-statism. Donald Trump is, in fact, more of a statist even than many Democrats, right? His rhetoric is all about taking the gloves off, both of people who are doing surveillance, of people who are doing torture for the government, and for cops, right? So in some sense, the whole rhetoric of the Trump campaign is an attempt to pull conservatives back from where they've been, in a way, pull them all the way back 30 years to a very different kind of law and order conservatism that has both the lack of anti-statism that came in with the Tea Party and the lack of sort of forgiveness and compassion that's been brought by social conservatives.
So would you see his election as a threat to the movement that you're writing about?
Well, I would say a threat, just period. We don't need to actually even clarify beyond that.
But certainly
to this, right? Absolutely, right? And I think that many of the people who are in this movement are terrified by what Trump is doing to conservatism. And I should just say, this movement is pretty much exclusively been an elite movement, right? This is not a movement that really there's any evidence that it has a huge capture and a mass base. And I think this is one thing that many conservatives weren't sufficiently, I think, aware of or careful about recognizing, which is that this is not something that your average walking around conservative, and especially Trump voter, ever bought into. This is something they were able to do because people weren't paying attention, because people weren't agitated about crime.
Let's see if we can squeeze in a quick question from John calling us from Baltimore. John, welcome to Midday.
Yes. I guess I'm on the air.
Yes, you are.
I used to work in a prison, and I noticed we had a really good rehabilitation program. Some of them would have cost a civilian several thousand dollars to participate in, and I noticed a large portion of the individuals, even though work would be offered to them out there, they would continue committing crimes because, for example, some drug sellers make a lot more money than you would with the 9-to-5. What's a way to combat that? What's a way to show them that kind of easy money is not as valuable as good, hardworking, you know, civilian conscious money.
John, you've posed a big question. We have just a minute or so to answer it, but I appreciate your calling, John. Thank you.
I think I'm going to punt because I don't know the answer, but I will say this, that the question John puts on the table is going to be one that might determine the future of this movement for two reasons. One is it's a question that liberals and conservatives are going to disagree about profoundly. What do we do with people once they get out of prison? What are the reasons people commit crimes? And do we need to tackle what do we see as the root causes of crime? Those issues haven't really been central to the discussion yet. And if they become so, they might become a real source of division. The other thing is that if we don't institute the right policies and we let people out of prison and see that they keep reoffending, this movement is going to be dead in the water.
The fact that there have been 152 homicides in Baltimore so far this year, 344 during last year. I mean, crime, your book is written in the context of crime having fallen during the 90s. It may be resurging. What does that say for this movement?
I mean, I'm willing to say that I don't think that this movement can survive in a sustained increase in crime. And that's one of the reasons I think that people on the left, on the liberal side, like I think me and David, we really need to take seriously this increase in crime. We can't just treat it as a blip. We can't treat it as something that is due to, you know, forces beyond anyone's control, right? Baltimore and other cities really need to get both their community relationships with the African-American community and the quality of their policing to be able to face this. And if they don't put the resources in it, if they don't put the time in trying to actually change how police behave and this crime increase goes up, you're definitely going to see, if not a reversal, at least a stalling in the movement to actually reduce mass incarceration.
I'm really grateful to both of you for this hour. This has been really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Sheila.
David DeGan is a doctoral student in political science at Johns Hopkins. Steve Tellis is associate professor in political science. Together they wrote Prison Break, Why Conservatives Turned Against Mass Incarceration. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I also want to thank Dangerously Delicious Pies for providing lunch today for Midday Guests. Dangerously Delicious Pies has locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow for a conversation on zoos. Is there such a thing as a good zoo? I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon. Stay cool.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.